Well, good morning. Today is the 2nd of January in the year 2022. And so those of you that may be joining us by way of Sermon Link, we invite you to turn with us to the book of Acts, chapter 18. We have concluded our Nativity series last month in the month of December as we considered the person of Satan, the red dragon of Revelation 12, how he tried in great desperation to undo the coming of the man-child of Revelation 12. Well, we've turned the page on that, and now we are resuming one of our series that we placed on the back burner towards the end of 2021. And so we're going to resume here for a while. We're going to stay in the book of Acts. And Acts chapter 18 here this morning, I'd like to read in our hearing verses 1 and following. After these things, after Paul leaves Athens, Paul departed from Athens and came to Corinth, and found a certain Jew named Aquila, born in Pontus, which is in modern-day Turkey, lately come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because that Claudius, this is Emperor Claudius, who is the uncle of the next emperor, Nero, had commanded all Jews to depart from Rome, and came unto them. And because he was of the same craft, of the same occupation, he abode with them. Paul stayed with this Christian couple, and wrought, for by their occupation, they were tent makers. And he reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath, and persuaded the Jews and the Greeks. And when Silas and Timotheus were come from Macedonia, they were still up north, while Paul had journeyed by himself to the south, being alone in Athens, and initially coming into Corinth alone. Now Silas and Timothy hook up with Paul in Corinth. Paul was pressed in the spirit and testified to the Jews that Jesus was Messiah, or the Christ. And when they opposed themselves and blasphemed, he shook his raiment and said unto them, Your blood be upon your own heads. I am clean. From henceforth I will go unto the Gentiles. And he departed thence and entered into a certain man's house named Justus, one that worshipped God, whose house was joined hard to the synagogue, meaning it was right next door. And Crispus, the chief ruler of the synagogue, believed on the Lord with all his house. So here's another household conversion experience, like Cornelius of Acts 10, Lydia of Acts 16, and the Philippian jailer of Acts 16. Here's another instance, as it's recorded faithfully by Luke, of a household coming to faith collectively. Not just one individual, but an entire household. And many of the Corinthians, hearing, believed, and were baptized. Then spake the Lord to Paul in the night by a vision, Be not afraid. Now, why do you think Jesus was telling Paul, don't be afraid? Well, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to draw the conclusion that after all that Paul was going through here, these meetings in the synagogue and the reaction on the part of the Jews that's mentioned in verse 6, opposition and blasphemy, Paul was afraid and he needed to be calmed. Okay? Be not afraid, but speak and hold not thy peace. For I am with thee, and no man shall set on thee to hurt thee, for I have much people in this city. And he, Paul, continued there a year and 6 months, teaching the word of God among them. And when Gallio was the deputy of Achaia, okay, that was that region of Greece that he was presiding, he's a Roman official, the Jews made insurrection with one accord against Paul, and brought him to the judgment seat, saying, quote, "This fellow persuaded men to worship God contrary to the law," unquote. So notice their accusation. The accusation here is not of one of insurrection, you know, we're going to overturn the Roman Empire. It's not one of high treason. Paul's not being brought before this Roman official under thievery, extortion, desecrating a building, setting the city on fire. Notice the charge. This fellow persuaded men to worship God contrary to the law. Now, before we go any further, what do they mean by the law? Now, you have the law of Moses, which is found in the Old Testament, very clear and very plain for you and I to read. But what had happened by the time Jesus comes on the scene, and what was continuing to happen amongst the Jewish population within that first century? They had the law of Moses, but what did they do to that law? They added more interpretation and went beyond the letter of the law. They went outside that law. Jesus refers to this, for instance, on the Sermon on the Mount. How often do you hear Jesus say, "You have heard it said to do such and such, comma, but I say unto you," period. You find that verbiage found in the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus was actually correcting the misinterpretation of the law of Moses, as the Jews were now interpreting it. You got to realize that prior to Jesus coming on the scene, prior to John the Baptist coming on the scene, prior before the 12 apostles were called, and prior before the days of Paul himself, 400 years prior to the arrival of these key figures, you had the system of the Sanhedrin evolving or developing. The sect of the Pharisees and the sect of the Sadducees. One sect more liberal in their mind and in their interpretation. The Pharisees went beyond the law, adding all kinds of interpretations and restrictions. For instance, what accusation did they bring against Jesus for healing on the Sabbath? As far as they were concerned, when Jesus healed someone in the synagogue on the Sabbath day, he was working and therefore was violating the Sabbath. When they went out in the field on the Sabbath, and as they were hungry, and they picked the grain, and they were rubbing it in their hand in order to get to the kernel, that they could at least eat something before they had a good meal, they were accused of cooking, because you were generating heat, and that heat was cooking, and thus you were violating the law of Moses. So Paul here in no way violated the law of Moses when it was properly interpreted and understood. Okay? Their accusation was, this guy is coming along and he has brought his own twisted interpretation of what Moses said. We have what we think Moses said. Paul is now bringing something that sounds contrary to what we think Moses meant. And that's the accusation. Paul was not violating the law willy-nilly, okay, just to cause an offense. Paul had the right understanding of the law, because now under the light of the New Testament, what were the apostles doing when you read their epistles? They were shining the understanding of the New Covenant light back to the Old Testament scriptures, which they liberally quoted from, right? What are they doing? Casting light on how to interpret. This is what Isaiah meant. This is what Zechariah was pointing to. This is what this is to whom Malachi was talking about in that chapter 3 or chapter 4 of his book. All right? Paul was handling the law properly. These guys in the synagogue, their teachers and their leaders and those who expounded the law of Moses, was coming from it from the writings of their rabbis that came before them, going way beyond what Moses said. And I felt the need to point that out. And when Paul was now about to open his mouth, verse 14, Gallio said unto the Jews, if it were a matter of wrong or wicked lewdness, now that's important. The accusation against Paul, again, was not treason. It wasn't extortion. It wasn't going around burning half the city. Okay? O ye Jews, you can see the frustration here. O ye Jews, reason would that I should bear with you. But if it be a question of words and names and of your law, look ye to it, for I will be no judge of such matters. And he drave them, or he drove them, away from the judgment seat. Then all the Greeks took Sosthenes, the chief of the chief ruler of the synagogue, and beat him before the judgment seat. And Gallio cared for none of those things. Okay, now, we've been out of the book of Acts here for a couple of months as we were gearing up for our Nativity series, which we just concluded. Let's kind of get the feel. The Apostle Paul leaves Athens, okay, and on the map, Athens is roughly here, and Corinth is, you have these, this little, it looks just like a hand, this part of southern Greece, and there's a little isthmus that connects this portion to the mainland. So you got the mainland, and you got this thing that looks like a hand with the fingers extended, and the top of the hand is connected, okay, with a narrow land bridge to the mainland. And right where they, where these two pieces of land meet, right in the middle of that bridge of land, is the city of Corinth. And so it has an east port and a west port to the city. And so it was an ideal place for commerce, for trade, and making a profit. Besides that, everything from the east and everything from the west, culturally speaking, would eventually land in Corinth by virtue of shipping and trade. When people went to Corinth, okay, they just didn't dump off their cargo and then head home. They probably stayed, got their ship re-rigged again, ready to go back home. So there was some time that they would spend in Corinth. So what are you going to do when you're an outsider and you're a foreigner living in a Greek city-state or this particular city? You would eventually be allowed in time to build your own temple to your own God. And therefore, when you went there, you knew you had a place to probably bed down, some type of a inn or a hotel, if you will. And you also had a place to go worship the God of your geographical location. And that's what you find in Corinth. Matter of fact, if you take Corinth in the first century, you would find little difference in any major city anywhere in the world. What do you find in most major cities? All kinds of churches, all kinds of stripes of churches, right? All different persuasions, all different denominations. You got mosques, you got synagogues, right? And you even have the Church of Satan. You even have the LGBTQY, X, Y, and Z out there as well. Corinth and New York City, you would feel at home in both locations, in both cultures. And yet God, in his infinite wisdom, chose to plant a local church right in the middle of that cesspool. Just like today, when you start a church, plant a church, or go to a foreign field, it is no different. You're just like Paul, walking into a cesspool of all kinds of isms swimming around you. And so a church can thrive in a cesspool, provided the church remains faithful to the truth. It can survive. It may not be the biggest church on the block, but you will find a congregation of serious-minded believers who love the truth, guard that truth, propagate that truth, and then they go out with that truth to minister to their local community. That's what you're going to find. So here's Paul. He goes there. And fortunately, he has company. He has a Christian couple, Aquila and Priscilla. Not only are they Christians, they have the same job or the same trade. Okay, look at verse 3. And because he was of the same craft or the same occupation or the same trade, Paul chooses now to abode with them and work alongside of them because they were tent makers. Now, when it says a tent maker, don't get the picture of the tent you go down to the local sports place and some little half-moon jobby with some metal framework, and you throw this colored plastic thing, whatever, spike it in the ground, and there's maybe room for two or three people the most without coughing in each other's face. That's not what we're talking about. When they talk about a tent, they're talking about something that you would find Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob living. Tents that had compartments, rooms divided by curtains for privacy. But nonetheless, where a family, a sizable family, could live comfortably. So these were not little pump tents to go off camping or fishing at the local scenic spot somewhere in the Roman Empire. These were big tents. And so that's how Paul and this couple brought in their income. Then in verses 4, we find that Paul here was reasoning. Now, listen to the definition. Now, I know that we covered this before, but we've been out of pocket with Acts 18 for several months, and so we need to get back into our thinking if we're going to go any further in this book and glean profitably. What does it mean here when it says Paul reasoned with them? Listen to what this word means. It means to think different things with oneself. Okay, up until this point, the Jews in the first century, after coming across 400 years of silence from the closing of Malachi, right, to the heralding of the birth of John the Baptist, and then eventually the heralding and the announcement of the birth of the Christ, you had 4 centuries where there was no further revelation given to the nation of Israel. Once you get past Malachi, that's it. Well, what happened in those 400 years? What happens to any church if it survives several decades? Well, if you're not careful, you're going to begin to accept and you're going to begin to assimilate in your teaching certain things of the world that ought not to be brought into the church. If a church is not careful, and if these synagogues during that 400-year period were not careful to guard the Old Testament and to handle the scriptures properly, and you have rabbis who were popping up during those 400 years, interjecting what they thought Moses said or what God meant, and they begin to write that down. What happens in the course of time when you have a study Bible? What happens in the course of time when somebody uses a study Bible that's written by a prominent evangelical man? The study notes begin to bleed into the text and form the understanding and the interpretation of what the Bible is saying. And there are sometimes, beloved, when those study notes on the bottom of a study Bible, beloved, may lead you down the wrong pathway. For instance, in the original Scofield Reference Bible of the early 1900s, in the notes there in Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, in Genesis chapter 1, verse 2, and I think it's also still maintained in the revised version of the Scofield Reference Bible, Dr. Scofield, quote unquote, who was really not a doctor, with no real proof of a doctorate degree, he advocated the gap theory, that there was a unspecified amount of time between Genesis 1:1 and 1:2, where there was a pre-Adamic race, the fall of Satan and the angels, God casting them to the earth, destroying the planet, what a global flood at that point, and wiping away the so-called pre-Adamic race. And then in Genesis 1:2, you have this ball of water, which is nothing more but the leftover of God's judgment on the planet and upon the pre-Adamic race. And then God recreates out of this void, out of this judgment mess left behind, God recreates everything in 6 days. It's a recreation, not the creation out of nothing. Well, beloved, a lot of people believe that even to this day. Some of your pastors may even hold to this position. And how did that come about? Well, the reference notes at the bottom of the page eventually became part of the actual text of the scriptures, and you just can't chisel that out of someone's mind. And so when Paul here was reasoning with the Jews in the synagogue, he was attempting to have them think differently than what they had been taught by the interpretation of the rabbis who came before them. And we have to do the same thing today. There are a lot of people who call themselves Christians, who attend churches, well-known established churches that have come from a particular denominational background, and some of the things that they hear and some of the things that they hold to don't even square with the scriptures. And even in that vein, you have to persuade them. You have to challenge them. Notice in that verse 4, notice, he reasoned and persuaded. Beloved, there's a lot of false teachings out here today that's found in churches. I'm sorry to tell you that. There are some off-the-wall ideologies and off-the-wall isms that you can find in any conservative church today. Now, the liberal churches, we just simply sweep them off to the side. They're already gone. Okay? There's several generations prior to those liberal churches today where all of that liberalism was allowed to come in, and now it's so permeated, it's so entrenched, that the liberal churches, you can just simply wipe them off the map in your mind. They don't even count. But you have conservative churches, so-called evangelical conservative churches, so-called Bible-believing churches, that when you listen carefully to what comes from the pulpit, you kind of wonder if they believe in a Bible at all. Okay? It also means here to mingle through with thoughts. It means to ponder, to resolve in one's mind, to converse. Now notice, discourse with one, to argue, to discuss, to reason. You know, some people today try to sound very holy and pious when they say that you shouldn't argue. Well, that's what this word means. When Paul was in this particular synagogue in this particular city, and we find the same things elsewhere prior to chapter 18, when he does go into the synagogue of the Jews, it wasn't, initially it may have been a happy-go-lucky, hunky-dory exchange. But then as Paul continued in his discourse and was connecting the dots with the Old Testament prophecies pointing to the Messiah, and then Paul would then connect that dot with Jesus of Nazareth, what he said and what he did and how he died, how he was buried, and how he rose again the third day, and how he ascended to heaven, and the miracles that he performed and the atonement that he accomplished, then, beloved, the hunky-dory turned to blasphemy and contradiction. This idea that Christians ought not to argue. My word, what did Jesus do in Matthew chapter 23? Okay, he was quite open and quite forceful with his denunciation of the entire religious establishment of his day. And when you look at Paul in these particular synagogue situations, it got hot and it got heated with that exchange. So there are times and seasons, beloved, that does occur. Notice also, it says... the word opposed. And he reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath and persuaded. Now the word here for persuade is quite interesting. It means to induce one by words to believe. To induce. To induce one by words to believe. To make friends of. To win one's favor. To gain one's goodwill. To seek to win one, strive to please one, to persuade unto, that is to move or induce one to persuasion to do something, to be persuaded, to suffer oneself to be persuaded, to be induced to believe, to have faith in a thing, to believe, to be persuaded of a thing concerning a person, to listen to obey, to yield to comply with, to trust and have confidence, to be confident. Beloved, that's a word that doesn't sound to be neutral, let alone passive. Paul here, beloved, was pouring out of himself to his brethren in the flesh, Jews. One Jew talking to another Jew in their synagogue. And not only that, verse 4 tells us, Jews and the Greeks. I would say that this was referring to the Greeks who were proselytes, who had converted from polytheism to monotheism and becoming a proselyte. For instance, Cornelius of Acts 10. And when Silas and Timotheus were come from Macedonia, Paul was pressed in the spirit and testified to the Jews that Jesus was Christ. He was pressed. He was burdened. Okay? Probably Paul lost a little bit of sleep. You can almost see Paul agonizing in prayer when he was alone in his room over his people. And the stubbornness that he was seeing coming from them. And when they opposed themselves, okay, verse 6, this word means to rage in battle, to resist. Now, have you come across people who have resisted you when you made an appeal to the truth or to the facts of the matter? Does everyone that you come in contact have a listening ear? Those that you come in contact, friend or family, co-worker, neighbor, do they automatically bow to what you're saying? Or do you sense a little bit of hostility when you begin to press certain buttons or bring up certain things or say certain words or use certain terms, and then you begin to define your terms and what it means? Is everyone just happy and jolly to receive what you're saying? Of course not. But that word, when they opposed themselves, notice they weren't opposing Paul. Now the opposition is to themselves. And the word means to rage in battle. So this is proof that the exchange in this synagogue went from happy clappy to World War III in an exchange of words. And anger, fervent anger, veins were bulging, hands clenched, maybe shaking in Paul's face. It got a little hot in the synagogue. They had to open up a few more windows. And it says they blasphemed. This word in the Greek means to speak reproachfully, to rail at, to revile, to speak evil of. It got hot. And yet we have Christians today who tell us that our exchange with the unbeliever should never reach this limit. Well, it did here. Now, I'm not advocating you just go out there for the sake of raising the heat. What I am advocating is if you're going to be faithful to the truth, all right, listen carefully to my words. If you're going to be faithful to the truth and how you present and proclaim that truth, with the understanding of the Old and the New Testament being brought together as one whole body of doctrine, and you present that unvarnished, uncompromising, beloved, the room's going to get hot. Even amongst those who claim to be believers. Now, stop and think. Was Paul dealing with a synagogue of atheists? Was he dealing with a synagogue of agnostics? No, he was actually dealing in a synagogue of those who claim to be believers in the one true living God. And I don't think anybody can argue against me on that one. These were not pagans. All right? These were Old Testament believers. Now that's what they would have told you. The problem with them was how they had handled the Old Testament text and how they had misinterpreted and how they were leaning upon the interpretations of fallible rabbis from their past. And they hooked up their train to that engine. And the train was on the wrong track. That's what it means. So notice, he was reasoning. He was trying to change their thinking. And he tried to persuade them. These are active words, not passive words. Not mealy mouth words. These are words denoting action, passion, pathos, feeling. They, in turn, opposed themselves, waging war against their own souls, and speaking reproachfully, railing at, and speaking evil of the things in which Paul was giving to them. Now, beloved, that is something that ought to make everyone here very much concerned. Because as a Christian, you can act the same way when given the truth. Especially if you're a babe in Christ and your understanding of the Bible is childish or immature, and somebody wants to come along and give you a little bit of meat and take away the milk bottle out of your mouth and feed you with a little bit of meat of the Word. If you're not careful, you're going to react and respond no differently than the Jews and the Greeks of this synagogue in the year around 51 AD. You would respond no different. You would respond much the same way. You would get angry. You would get in a huff and a puff. Okay? And versus being willing to learn something, my dear friends, you're going to find yourself in opposition to the truth. Allow me once again to read from Matthew Henry, his study Bible. And again, I'm not advocating that Matthew Henry is that he's infallible, but notice his words here on verses 5 and 6. Let me read these once again. Let me turn here to his study Bible, verses 5 and 6. Listen carefully. Under the term, when Silas and Timotheus were come, bringing good tidings from Macedonia, they were ready to assist him here and strengthen his hands. Then Paul was more than before pressed in spirit, which made him more than ever pressing in his preaching. You know, sometimes when a pastor seems to come across like a train going down the tracks, full throttle, some in the congregation take offense to that. Well, maybe that pastor's spirit is pressed so much that what he needs to say in regards to the truth is like a flood water coming out of his soul. And versus some in the church being critical of a pastor with that much concern for them and using all the passion and all the feeling and all the pathos to let that truth go forth, for them to be so critical and so condescending and so stubborn, you kind of wonder if those people are actually saved. Matthew Henry is trying to tell you what it means in that verse 5 when it says that Paul was pressed in spirit. Then Paul was more than before pressed in spirit, which made him more than ever pressing in his preaching. And if you're ever pressing in your preaching, you're not going to be in a monotone voice, calm, cool, collective, using right words, not to offend nobody. It's going to come out of you like a floodgate. The question is, have you prepared your heart and mind to receive God's word on that particular Sunday morning? Or did all of us just come here in a big rush, rushing to eat, rushing to get dressed, rushing to get to church on time, panting and breathing heavy, plopping ourselves in our plastic chair or in our pews, and then you expect God to turn on the switch when you made no preparation in your heart of hearts to receive whatever comes forth from your minister, if it be the truth? He was grieved for the obstinacy and the infidelity of his countrymen, the Jews, was more intent than ever upon their conversion, and the love of Christ constrained him to do it. Did not Paul say in 2 Corinthians 5:14, "For the love of Christ constraineth me"? Verse 6, "I will go unto the Gentiles." Notice what Matthew Henry says. He is abandoning the unbelieving Jews and turning from them to the Gentiles, as he had done in other places. Many Jews persisted in their contradiction to the gospel of Christ and would not yield to the strongest reasoning nor the most winning persuasion. Notice how Matthew Henry ties in those two words, reasoning and persuading. They opposed themselves and blasphemed. They were against the gospel. They resolved that they would not believe it themselves and would do all they could to keep others from believing it. Paul discharged himself from them by threatening the judgment of God against them. Now, beloved, if you did that in a modern church today, how would you be received? Because let's go back upon verse 6. "And when they opposed themselves," when they were waging war against themselves and now speaking evil against the things that Paul was giving to them, speaking evil of Christ, who died just like a criminal at the hands of the Romans. That's how they saw that. A literal interpretation. This man got in trouble with the Roman authorities, this poor Jew, this poor preacher, this poor itinerant preacher. He said the wrong things about the Romans and whatever, and they nailed him to a cross like a common criminal. He was buried, and that's it. Paul's coming along saying, no, if that's all you see, you've missed the mark. There was more going on that cross than simply a criminal dying. The work of atonement was being accomplished. Everything that you Jews in the first century held so dear to that was being done in that temple day after day was now finally realized and fulfilled and complete in the one who died on that tree. But not only that, he was buried, and 3 days and three nights later, according to his own prophecy, he walked out of that grave. And now he sits at the Father's right hand, full of all authority and power in heaven and in earth. Angels, good angels and bad angels, and even the devil being subject at his feet. They call that junk. They call that bunk. They call that lies. Just like people today. So you can see that Corinth, in the year 51-52 AD, is no different than downtown Topeka in 2022. Take any city, any village, any hamlet, any dot on the map, and you will find Corinth in spirit in that particular community. No different. No different. But then notice, he shakes his raiment and then says to them, "Your blood be upon your own hands. I'm clean." Now, the Jews would recognize that as referring to ceremonial cleaning. "From henceforth, I'm going to go to the dogs." Now, beloved, guess what? We have a hard time in the first century because we have sanitized Jesus and the gospel so much. We have sanitized even our Bible translations, taking away words that come across with a little sting. We have retranslated those words and made it into candy. We make sin into candy, make it sweet and palatable and enjoyable. Beloved, that was a sign of judgment. What would happen on a Sunday morning in one of our most popular mega churches today if the pastor got behind the pulpit and preached something similar to this and even went so far as to shake his suit coattails and take off his nice shoes worth maybe $100 or so and clap them together and simply shake off what dust or dirt was on the top of that podium or on that platform and look at his congregation and say, "I'm going to go to another people and they will hear me." Paul pronounced a judgment on those people by that gesture. That was a judgment, my friends. He was not passing out a sack lunch and a free bottled water. He wasn't passing out gospel literature. He judged them. Now the kicker is this. Go back to verse 4. It says that he did this every Sabbath day. Now, by the text, I'm assuming we have just one synagogue. Now, there may have been more than one synagogue in the city, because this was not some small little hamlet down here. This was a trading center. So there could have been a sizable Jewish population. So there is a possibility that there was more than one synagogue in the city. But I'm stuck what I find here. I'm looking at one synagogue. Okay? He reasoned in the synagogue, singular. Notice that there was a certain period of time that had transpired before Paul takes his action in verse 6. I want you to look at that. Now we do know that Paul is going to spend an additional 18 months. The period of time, though, before that 18 months, which we see back in verse 11 here. Look at verse 11. And Paul continued there a year and 6 months. Okay, verse 11 transpires after the event of verse 6. So we're not told how many weeks he was there. All we're told, he reasoned every Sabbath in this one synagogue. And it tells you what he was saying. It also tells you what their response was. Then during that period, Silas and Timotheus finally hook up with him, coming from the north, Philippi, Thessalonica, Berea, as they were ministering and following up. These two guys come down from northern Greece and eventually hook up with him in Corinth. All right, get the picture. Then you have several Sabbath meetings, several Sabbath weeks, and then finally Paul lets loose the hammer. Notice, he didn't spend decades with these people, and then the hammer falls. Was it 2 weeks? 3 weeks? 4? Don't know. But apparently, beloved, when you're dealing with people, there comes a time when the preacher has to make a choice of whether or not he's now casting his pearl under the feet of a swine. Didn't Jesus say that? Cast not your pearl before the swine, because they will trample it and rend you. Apparently, these poor people reached a point with Paul where he thought, I'm spinning my wheels. They're not really listening. The wheels are turning, but the car's not moving. Hence, I'm clean. Now, Paul could be referring to, go back to Ezekiel 33. Look at Ezekiel 33. What was Paul referring to? Let me show you. Verse 1. And the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Son of man, speak to the children of thy people. Well, that's what Paul was doing at that particular moment. He was in a synagogue, speaking to Jews and to Greek proselytes. And say unto them, when I bring the sword upon a land, and if the people of the land take a man of their coasts and set him for their watchman. So he's on sentry duty here. And that's the imagery of someone on guard duty. If when he seeth the sword come upon the land, when he sees the enemy coming over the horizon, with his chariots and his horsemen and his cavalry. He blow the trumpet and warn the people. Then whosoever heareth the sound of the trumpet, and taketh not warning, if the sword come and take him away, his blood shall be upon his own head. So Paul, I believe, was referring to the imagery here of a watchman. Apostle Paul was functioning on that particular occasion in this city, as he did elsewhere and as he would continue to do until the day of his martyrdom. He was a watchman. He was responsible to be on top on sentry duty with his binoculars, scanning the horizon and watching for the enemy. And he's in the synagogue on these, whatever it was, how long it was, how many weeks, we don't know, but there was a period of time that had transpired. He came in there like a watchman, and he was giving a warning. And then he was also sharing the remedy that can be attached or applied to the warning. And what was the warning? The judgment of God upon the unbeliever. And in this instance here, beloved, they gave no heed to the warning, no heed to the bell ringing, no heed to the town crier, no heed to fire, 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 no heed. And then the time came for Paul to shake off whatever dust was on his sandals and say to them, now again, the Greeks, a unbelieving Greek may not really appreciate these words, I am clean. I am clean. Being a Jew, talking to a Jew, they would automatically understand that as a ceremonial cleaning. Look at Acts 28, 28. Acts 28, 28. What does Paul say here? To the delegation of Jews that came to him in the city of Rome while he was awaiting his appeal before Caesar. Verse 27, for the heart of this people is waxed gross, and their ears are dull of hearing. No different than the synagogue there in Corinth. And their ears are dull of hearing, and their eyes have they closed, lest they should see with their eyes, and hear with their ears, and understand with their heart, and should be converted, and I should heal them. Notice in verses 27, this is not God blinding them. This is them blinding themselves. It's a willful choice not to hear and not to believe. Be it known, therefore, unto you, that the salvation of God is sent unto the dogs, and they will hear it. And when he had said these words, the Jews departed and had great reasoning among themselves. Wow. Wow. So we're going to stop here. And we're going to pick up in the next hour after we take a short break. But beloved, may I give you some admonishments here. You better be very careful, my dear friends, in how you hear. Not only what you hear, but how you hear. Notice also by way of application, way back in that verse 13, this fellow persuaded men. Notice they use the same word, persuaded, as you find in verse 4. This fellow persuaded men to worship God contrary to the law, not contrary to the law of Moses, as Moses intended it to say and mean, but contrary to how we interpret Moses. And again, I draw you back to the Sermon on the Mount. It has been told to you, or you have heard of old, pointing back to those 400 years of rabbinical interpretation and redefining, such and such, comma, but I say unto you, period. What was Jesus doing? Every time Jesus went out of his way to heal on the Sabbath, that really agitated the members of the synagogue. What was he doing? Not simply roughshoring the Sabbath and just desecrating it just to make a point. He was correcting the misinterpretation and the misuse of the Sabbath in his days at the hands of the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the lawyers and the priests and the elders. He was correcting misuse and misinterpretation. Not throwing the Sabbath out the window with the baby and the water and then the bathtub. He was addressing their phony interpretation and the wrong application that they were making on that particular day, going beyond what God said. And so, beloved, you have to be careful what you hear, how you hear. You have to be careful that you and I don't go beyond the scriptures. And that's why I pray, Lord, keep me within the guardrails of the Old and the New Testament. It's very easy to jump over the guardrail and go off a cliff in your theology. Well, at this point, may God choose to bless his word. Amen.